Support for KPLU and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, with a reminder that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Maybe we could just jump right into it. Walk me through the sequence of events here. How did this happen?
Well, what is the first punt of the game, I believe? And always extra special when I get to play in Seattle in front of my family, get a little hyped up.
Johnny Hecker lives in Edmonds, and he grew up in Bothell. But when he took the field at CenturyLink last December, it was as a St. Louis Ram opposite the Seahawks. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. And what Hecker did next made him pretty infamous here in his native Northwest.
It was just running down after I punted the ball, saw a body there, and decided to give him a little nudge. And, man, did not anticipate him going to the ground like that. Just caught him right at the right moment. You know, he's a big guy.
Personal foul. Unnecessary roughness, number six.
And then as soon as he hit the ground, I thought, man, oh, no.
When did it dawn on you who you had just given a shove to?
Right after he got back up, yeah, I saw it was Cliff Averill.
We see him take a shot here, Cliff Averill. I don't know if you want to go around doing that to that guy.
I wasn't trying to be tough or anything. I was just, you know, giving a guy a nudge, like a little running down the field. And
let's unpack the dynamic a little bit for people who might be like a Fairweather fan.
Okay.
So you are a big guy, but punters are not sort of stereotypically giants.
Right.
But Cliff Averill is.
Right. Big man. So we're actually not too far off. Sideline might be a little bit taller, but he's definitely got me in some muscle poundage.
But he's also kind of a trained killer, right?
Yes, I mean, yeah.
He's a pass rusher. He is. Right. He's out there to level people.
Yes.
And you're typically not having a lot of contact.
More of a finesse player, yeah. You know, it was a dumb play. And, of course, now I got four of the biggest guys on their team all mad at me trying to rip my head off. So I knew it was I kind of had to go in like self-preservation mode. It wasn't the most bright idea I've ever had in my life, I'll tell you that.
And how did the self-preservation mode play out?
Michael Bennett is a charging bull, and I am a matador in a sense. Just trying to not, you know, get gored out there in front of thousands. And,
so he takes a run at you on your next punt.
Yeah, he did, and I wasn't really having that. I punted the ball and shied away from contact, some would say.
He's going to avoid any kind of penalty. They saw what he did last time. Look, they want revenge.
I hate to needle you on it, but I describe physically how you evaded that maneuver. Like, what was your evasive maneuver?
There was a bit of going to the ground,
and
using
maybe
the hands and shoulder,
protecting your vital organs.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I already have a helmet protecting my head, so just curling up, kind of protecting the rest of the body, and not leave myself open to attack. Yeah.
And how did Averill and some of his teammates react? And did that change, like, in the heat of the moment versus a little later?
Of course, the heat of the moment, they were all very, very upset. But, you know, as time went on, they realized, you know, it's part of the game. We'll just let him live. You know, I got a lot of flack on the internet and all over. So it was the kind of thing where I think they realized that I had done more damage to myself than they could probably do. So it's just crazy because that kind of stuff happens. Then you have little third graders calling you all sorts of cuss words on the internet and saying you're a wuss. And you're like, wow.
So when all is said and done, do you regret doing it?
Do I regret doing it? That's a difficult question. There's yes and no. You know, that's how I play. I'm shouldn't really apologize for being an aggressive player and just building identity of being a tough guy, I guess. Well, not so tough guy, but.
Well, you're also a really good sport to come in and talk to
course.
Us about it. Thank
of course,
you so
man,
much.
Yeah. No hiding here. I'm excited. I'm in the area, so just to get to kind of clear my name a little bit. City of Seattle, please, you can love me now. Please.
Bothell native Johnny Hecker, now a punter for the LA Rams. And today on Sound Effect, we have stories of people living with no regrets. That's up next here on KPLU. Don't go away. Bellevue native Aaron Khanna always loved to build stuff. And when he went to college, someplace called Harvard, he got deep into computer science, and that love of building became a love of coding. He connected not just with the mechanics of it, but also with the hacker culture that surrounds it. And for Aaron, the mecca of hacker culture was Facebook. So it was a big deal when during his junior year, he got an offer for a summer internship at this company that he idealized and grew up with.
I mean, seventh grade, I remember signing up for Facebook. All my friends were on there. And I grew up using the site. It really became a part of my social identity. You know, beyond that, Facebook resonated with me because, you know, I loved building things. And I really thought that, like, politics in an organization really shouldn't dictate what ideas went out. It should really be the code that you write and the ideas that you bring to the table. And that was the culture that Facebook, or at least, you know, Facebook's recruiting staff was putting forward as exemplary of their culture. They're situated on One Hacker Way. That's literally the headquarters. They have a giant sign in the middle of their campus that says hack. How much more hacker-friendly do you think a company can be? And of course, I was taken in by this. It boils down to the fact that if you see something that is impacting users negatively, you should go out and write some code to fix it and move fast, ask questions later, and really, you know, use your code to prove your ideas.
So what did it mean to you to nail down that internship at this company that you admire and that you feel like is in sync with what you want to do philosophically?
It was incredible. I remember I was skiing with my family. We had just finished a run. I got a call from the recruiter that I had gotten the internship, and this was after 3-4 rounds of interviews, and I was absolutely just floored. I was so happy. I actually didn't even go out and ski the rest of the afternoon. I just kind of sat there and chatted with my friends who were also going to be at the company. I was really excited, and I thought that this was a place that I could make my career.
So you were raring to go, and in the spirit of hacker culture, you sort of decided to get a little bit of a jump on your internship. Can you just kind of spin the story of what happened and how you created Marauder's Map?
As a frequent messenger user,
this sort of Facebook's instant messaging.
Facebook's instant messenger service. I was a frequent user, and before this past summer, whenever you sent a message from your mobile device, by default, the app would attach your location to that message. And I found that a little bit frustrating, and I thought other users might as well, especially given that a lot of my friends ended up sharing their locations in not just small intimate chats, but also these huge group chats with complete strangers in them.
So rather than send an email saying, hey, I wanted to make sure that you are aware this is happening and perhaps you should consider the impact on your users, you went code first, because that's hacker culture.
Right. And this was a feature that had been around for years and written about publicly, even criticized by people. And I was just curious, like, what really is the impact of this feature? And is this something that users should be frustrated by? So I decided to go ahead and write some code. And then surprisingly, I found that I could track my classmates through this location data as they moved around Harvard. And then, you know, being a huge Harry Potter fan, I couldn't help but notice that the thing that I had made looked eerily similar to Harry's magical Marauder's Map, which let him track his classmates as they moved around, you know, Hogwarts.
And what was your intention with that? You weren't really trying to give people a way to track everybody, right?
No, this, I think, for me, was to just give users a bit of transparency.
So how did you imagine that Facebook would react to what you had done?
I thought Facebook would actually kind of appreciate the initiative that I took. You know, I did this because I thought that users are being negatively affected. And, you know, I thought that this would be well in line with Facebook's culture. And in fact, maybe it would win me some kudos over there.
So how did Facebook actually react? What happened?
I put the blog post out. And the week before I started my internship there, it went viral. And people began downloading the extension. The day that it started to go viral was the day I left Seattle in my little RAV4 driving down all the way to California to start my internship. And my phone was just exploding. I get emails and texts, and eventually I get a call from my manager. And she informed me just not to speak to the press, which I did. And I get another call from Facebook, and they tell me to deactivate the extension. And
so you basically turned it off.
I took the magic out of Marauder's Map. Then the Friday before I was supposed to start my internship, I get a call from the company informing me that I no longer had a job there because the map I'd created violated not any terms of service I signed under my employment contract, but the terms of service that I had with Facebook as a user, because I'd created some code that takes data off the site and redisplays it, which is apparently not allowed under your user contract with Facebook. You know, I definitely had a weekend of absolutely freaking out. because I rented this place in San Francisco, which is not a cheap city, for 3 months. Didn't have any way to pay for that, and I didn't have a job. But, you know, luckily I tried to get something together and eventually I ended up with a job for the summer.
Do you get a sense of why Facebook was so touchy about your app, about Marauder's Map?
It was obviously a damaging story for them. This vulnerability had sat around for so long, really made Facebook look bad. And I think, secondly, Facebook, as much as they want a hacker culture, I think they don't really want engineers who will step out of line. They want people who will just sit down and write the code they tell them to write.
And this was something you must have been looking forward to. It was kind of a dream of yours. So what did it feel like to see that slip away?
I was absolutely dejected. I was ready to drink the Facebook Kool-Aid, jump on board day one. I was so excited. It almost didn't feel real for the first day or two. I was still thinking, like, you know, maybe they'll just call me again and I'll be able to start. Maybe it was a mistake.
You were thinking, like, God, if Zuckerberg, does Zuckerberg know? Because he would have my back on this.
You know, that's what I thought. And actually, I did try to go through, like, the Harvard alumni directory and get Zuckerberg's email. I was just very hopeful that it was a mistake at first.
Yeah. What did this teach you about how Facebook works and maybe how giant companies in general work?
It's hard to keep that move fast and break things mentality, that hacker culture that I was, you know, so enamored of. But I think that more importantly, it really got me starting to think about privacy issues and the incentives that these companies have to actually act on features that could be privacy invasive and fix those.
So looking back now on your decisions, do you have any regrets about what you did?
No, I don't think I have any regrets looking back. I am happy that this happened because, to me, you know, internship's almost like dating someone, right? You want to make sure that that company is a good fit for you and vice versa, you're a good fit for the company. And I think that I realized before I even started dating Facebook that we wouldn't have been a good fit together.
You still use Facebook?
I do. One of my biggest concerns, actually, was that they were going to deactivate my Facebook. So I immediately went in and started downloading all the photos off of my wall and trying to, you know, get all the information I wanted saved off of there before they nuked it. But they actually never did. So luckily, I'm still kicking on Facebook.
That's great. Well, Aran Khanna is from the Seattle area originally. He's now a student at Harvard. And he was the author of the Marauder's Map app, which cost him a Facebook internship, but perhaps gained him a little bit of insight and wisdom. Thank you so much, Aran.
Thank you so much for having me, Gabriel.
It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Our theme today is No Regrets. And I'm coming to you now from the dunes just above Long Beach, which is in the southwest corner of Washington. And I'm standing right next to about 6 feet of a backbone and some pieces of a skull. Basically, this is the front third of a dead gray whale. And the remains of this whale are actually the remains of what under one kind of light might look like a pretty major civic debacle. But behind it is a story that has quickly transformed into a piece of local folklore. And so to get the backstory, I went and hunted down a guy. His name is Jim Sace. He's a natural historian based here in Seaview, right next door to Long Beach.
You know, it starts with a common phenomena on the northwest coast here, and that is whales die and they drift ashore. The whale will decompose on site. And have you ever smelled a whale that's decomposing?
Indirectly, but that's another story. So yeah, it's
that,
rough.
That forms the core of this story. But over the years, state agencies and local governments struggled with what to do with the whales. There was a famous case in Oregon where they actually blew a whale up to get rid of it. But a whale is so big, and by big, the whale that we're going to talk about weighed 15 tons, just under 30,000 pounds. Well, what do you do with it? Well, you hire a local contractor to go out with a very large excavator and bury it. And in this particular case, this whale came in here north of Long Beach, and we knew that it was going to start to decompose, and so we rolled it up the beach, just like a large driftwood log. Boom, boom.
Was the idea to do something unusual or make use of it, did that come after the decision to bury it or before?
After.
So you were able to roll it up the beach.
This is the era of Lewis and Clark and the bicentennials coming along. Remember, this is the early part of this century. And we have this 200-year commemoration of the Lewis and Clark expedition. One of the things the expedition saw when they walked up the Long Beach Peninsula were the bones of a whale. The bones of a whale. One day, Nabil Shaba, who's the city administrator, and myself were talking to him. Well, what are we going to do for the bicentennial? We both looked at each other and thought, well, we just buried this whale. Why don't we go dig it up? You know. And now when I look back on that, I thought, how crazy were we? But that's what we did.
How long had it been underground?
Not quite a year. So we got permission to dig up the whale and display the remains in the repose that it was found on the beach, laying on its side. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
And this would be an attraction for people who are walking along the trail, who came here for the bicentennial, and give them a little flavor of what it might have been like to be Lewis and Clark wandering along the beach and encountering this thing.
Right. Think of it this way. If you and I were on the beach 150 years ago, we would see lots of dead things on the beach on a regular basis. This gives the public a way to go, wow, that was pretty cool. The things that big live out there.
So you had this vision, and then you thought about the whale that was underground. What happened next?
Basically, it was, well, we should just dig it up and see what it looks like. Because actually, we didn't know. So we hired the same contractor, and we went out, and we just started digging. And the mayor at the time, Dale Jacobson, was very enthusiastic about this. And so he allowed the crew to come and work, and he recruited a bunch of children out of the high school to come and work. So there was a whole gang of us out there.
This was a civic pride thing.
And it took us a couple days. And here was this striking thing. Literally all the flesh had decomposed. However, what did remain was the oily blubber residue.
What did it look like?
The soil was darkened as if it had been mixed with extremely heavy bunker oil or machine oil of some type. And we discovered instantly that, did that ever stink? I mean, that whole area lit up like the devil's garbage dump, I mean. You could walk within like 200 or 300 yards and you could smell it. And worse, it stuck to everything. It stuck to shoes and gloves and pants. Literally, people were throwing away their wet working gear and their boots because they couldn't get it off. It was like stunning. And that hung with us for weeks, weeks upon weeks upon weeks.
Was there a moment when you were pulling up these blubber-slicked bones out of the muck, stinking the world up, that you thought, let's just call this thing off. This is a bad idea.
No. We asked ourselves, what have we got ourselves into? But by God, we're going to get ourselves out of it. Now, what we did do is we assembled all the bones, and then the mayor had, in his wise way, had concocted this method of heating up water with a little bit of common cleaning solution, and we made the world's largest bone cooking pot.
Out of what?
Out of a construction dumpster. And we slowly steeped and kept them warm for about a week while we're trying to get all the oils out of the bone and get them clean. And
I'm just going to stop you right there, because this has got to be the weirdest public works project I've ever heard of. I mean, this is like the mayor's idea, city crews.
Yes,
this is a municipal project to boil this whale off.
Yes, and we would comment, well, what's going on with the whale? Well, it's in the, you know, it's been cooking away. We're just boiling the bones of a whale.
Did this come up in like city council meetings,
whale
status update?
Everybody, as I recall, it was always more of like, this is crazy. Because you get so far into it, you wonder, have we gone in so far that we can't get out? And is this the world's craziest idea that we should just stop now and say, yeah, we tried and we failed. But no, we kept going on. And then we brought it down on a trailer and then put it in place and then epoxied, bolted it to the concrete structure, mount of the head, and it looked just like a whale. It was absolutely jaw-dropping. Now, most whales that are rearticulated are hung in museums. We decided that, you know, we really wanted this on the trail, and the expedition talked about seeing the bones of the whale. So we put it up, and I watched it, and I could see that two things were going on. It began to degrade. I suspect teenage kids would go out at night and take parts of it off And despite us having screwed and glued and bolted it together, they were prying them off. And so over a period of a decade plus, it just started to degrade until one point it was like, we got to do something with the whale. And Dave Glasson, who's the city administrator, in his discussions with the council, they wisely decided to replace it with a smaller version of a wooden sculpture, which is there today.
So, I mean, this could read, if you were to be uncharitable, like a boondoggle. Do you have any regrets about it? Would you do it differently now?
I don't have any regrets, no. It's not a reason not to do art, because it truly is art.
What does it say about this community that you were able to keep everybody sort of on board for this crazy project, including the mayor, through pulling this thing out of the ground, through putting it in the giant whale crock pot? you know, people didn't really bat an eye.
Some of my economic development friends would say, well, that's our resilience. That's our resilience. And if it makes us try things out that we've never done before, that's okay, because life should be filled with a bit of trial and error. How else will we know who we are?
Jim Sace is a natural historian who lives in Seaview, right next to Long Beach, Washington, and one of the architects of the Long Beach gray whale skeleton. I don't know what you'd call it. Epic.
Myth.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks very much. Take care, Gabriel.
Special thanks to Natalie St. John at the Chinook Reporter for help with that story. This is Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week our show is all about no regrets. So this is a story about a young woman who's ready to make a decision that will affect the rest of her life, and a bunch of older people who think they know better. Bree Ripley is a radio producer in Seattle, and she's ready to have her tubes tied. And by that I mean she wants a relatively minor operation that would make her permanently sterile. But she's discovered that doctors are extremely reluctant to do that procedure on someone just out of college. And all wrapped up in the politics and the gender issues here is the worry that Ripley will regret the decision when she's older. But Bree Ripley has always planned to be a child-free person. And that goes back to when she was a kid herself. So put me back in time, young Bree, in her saddle shoes.
They were more like Adidas.
Okay, young Bree and her little Adidas playing house as a kid. Did you have children in those scenarios when you were imagining a grown-up Bree back then?
No, not at all. I mean, I was playing Sims a lot, the computer game. And I was more focused on relationships. I would make relationships blow up, and I would make relationships loving and long, and children were just not a part of that.
And where did that come from? How did your feelings about yourself having kids form?
It's being influenced from seeing women on television who are stuck in the home, having their careers stunted or shortened because of their children. The women that I looked up to as a kid were Nancy Drew. They were, you know, detectives. They were women who were solitary. They were strong. And I found out later on that I was an unplanned pregnancy. And that influenced in a lot of ways the surprise factor. So I never want that to be something that I face.
So you knew you didn't want to have a child. How did it first occur to you to pursue a permanent solution rather than something that was temporary or more easily reversible?
I had so many failed, hectic, awful experiences with birth control. When I was 18, I went in and I got the IUD, and the procedure itself is so terrible. They, you know, insert this small device that looks like a T-shape with a fishing string at the end. It hurts so bad. I had to take Tylenol all the time. Not only that, but then I started having reactions to it. I started having chronic yeast infections every single month.
These are side effects of the IUD?
I mean, besides the cramping and, you know, the irregular periods that will, I guess, for some women eventually disappear. You don't have a period. And finally, I said, I need this out of me. And so that was compromising, not only my health and my comfortability, but also the intimacy with my partner.
So let's skip ahead a little bit and kind of cut to the chase. What is your plan at this point for your own reproductive future?
My plan is to get my tubes tied.
As a, how old are you?
23.
As a 23-year-old woman, how do you go about getting sterilized?
It's a long and arduous process. In the beginning, I started asking at 17 when I had...
You first brought this up when you were 17 years old?
Oh, yeah, with my doctors.
How did they react to your question?
They didn't take me seriously. They said that there was no way a doctor would sterilize a woman who had not yet had her first child. I mean, the point of sterilization is not to have biological children, to prevent pregnancy. So I was confused.
So you got that reaction when you first brought it up when you were 17. So now that you're older, you're a college graduate, you're a professional, how have the reactions changed to your proposal?
At first, it turned into nobody taking me seriously.
Still?
Even still, but the reasoning turned into, you're going to change your mind. You will regret this later. The remorse rate for women at your age is large. It will decrease the older that you get.
How many healthcare professionals would you say you have approached with this question by now?
Nearly a dozen.
A dozen different people, and none of them have said okay?
None of them have said okay.
Did you tell your parents, and how did they think about it?
I've been talking about this with my parents for years. I've told them that, you know, I'm not willing to compromise my personal health, you know, with the yeast infections, with the painful periods, with, you know, the acne, with the weight gain. I'm not willing to go through that when I don't want to have biological children. It just doesn't make sense. And I still want to protect myself against pregnancy.
And how does she feel about it?
My mom is really supportive. My mom is also a, you know, an interesting artist type. You know, she really believes in people making strides towards what they want and having a vision and living that vision. What was most surprising to me was the conversation I had with my dad. He told me he was really impressed with the initiative that I'm taking to have something for myself that I truly want and am running after. I'm running towards this.
They're not worried about not having grandkids or worried about you kind of repudiating the choices that they made?
I don't think my parents are worried about not having grandkids. But my stepdad, I call him my dad, he took my sister and I in. We were a package deal when he married my mom. And so he's very familiar with the idea that, you know, children can be your own even if they aren't biological. And so I think that is one of the reasons why he is so supportive of this, is because he knows that there are as many ways to be a mother as there are as many ways to call a place home.
Is that something you could imagine potentially entertaining down the line? A situation where you had children who weren't your biological children, or you were a mother in some other way?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I've imagined myself, you know, in a second career as a children's therapist. I've imagined myself as a social worker, somebody who fosters children. I've imagined myself as a potential parent who adopts. They don't talk to you about that when you are pursuing sterilization. They don't counsel you about the fact that you can carry your own child if you so choose, even after becoming permanently sterilized. They don't talk to you about adoption. They don't talk to you about fostering. They don't talk to you about, you know, being a mentor or a role model for somebody.
So let me ask you the question that all the doctors are asking you. What if you regret this? What if you change your mind?
I am steadfast in my belief that becoming child-free is ultimately the birth control option for me.
But can you see their point of view that people who are older look back on their time in their early 20s and think, wow, I was a very different person then. I would make a lot of decisions differently then. And the idea of making a decision on behalf of your future self now, to some people seems like, well, she doesn't realize how much change there could be in the way that she's thinking. So I don't know. What do you make of that idea? Can you see that point of view that you just might think about things differently when you're, say, 35?
I hear that point of view. But let me ask you this. Do you think that there are women who have looked back on their life and said, I wasn't a very good mother. I could have stepped up and been a better parent. I wasn't prepared when I was 18, 19, 20, 35 to be a mom. Maybe I didn't have to leave my career and stay at home. I think there's another side of that coin.
You've been working on a radio documentary about this quest to get your tubes tied and the barriers that you have faced, partly funded with this award that you got from the Pat Cranston Endowed Fund at the UW. So who have you talked to for that documentary who have had stories that have really stuck with you?
You know, I talked with this woman who served as legal counsel for Planned Parenthood, and she pioneered the Fair Access to Contraception Project. And she told me stories about women being denied simple, basic rights like to birth control and to abortion and to tubal ligations, and how she, you know, has been making strides for over 30 years to make it so women can have body autonomy, to make it so that this isn't political, this is personal.
Well, Bree Ripley is a producer in Seattle, a former intern for this program, and she's producing a documentary called Tie My Tubes about her quest to get permanently ligated, I guess. Is that the verb?
Maybe. I'll put that in my research.
Okay. Thank you for coming on our show, Bree.
Thank you, Gabriel.
Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is a guy determined to live out his life with no regrets.
It's just so natural because as an adult, and even if you're only in your 20s, say, how can you look at a child and say, no big deal if they die or they suffer? It's just, I can't even imagine that. And to have the opportunity to prevent their deaths, that's a pretty great thing to do.
That's the voice of Bob Dickerson. Bob died last year. He had been given a terminal cancer diagnosis and told that he could expect to live between 1 and 20 years. He ended up making it about 15. But what's special about Bob Dickerson is how he chose to spend those years. Instead of giving up or taking it easy, he dedicated the rest of his life to an organization called Results. They work to stop preventable child deaths, among other things. And during the time he volunteered with Results, the number of child deaths worldwide was cut in half. We talked with his brother, Willie Dickerson, about what kind of person Bob was.
He was a classic big brother, helped me out when I needed it and sometimes when I didn't want it, but always my best friend. We got that way moving around when my dad was in the service. You could always count on your family.
I have a big brother, too. And there were certain moments through childhood that kind of crystallized my worship of him, I guess. Where you said you really looked up to him. And I was just wondering if there were times that you could remember that really stood out to you, what a role model he was for you.
One of the amazing things when we were living in Lakewood and we'd ride our bikes up to American Lake. We would go out and go swimming. And one time when we went, we were playing on the raft that was out there. And suddenly I looked and my brother was gone. And it turned out he had seen two girls that were struggling, that they couldn't swim and they were out over their heads. And he managed to get to them when no one else seemed to see him and grabbed them and kind of put them on his shoulders while he walked along the bottom till he got them to shore where they ran to their parents. That was a live hero.
Wow. So as you moved into adulthood, the two of you, what kind of guy was he?
He became a lawyer. He went to law school. He was known around the firm as someone who was friends with everyone from the janitor to the other partners. He was just an amazing guy, although he was pretty clear about what he wanted and what he thought was right. So at times he could be a stickler.
So how did it come about that he got his diagnosis?
It had been kind of a pattern with him for at least 10 years where he would not be feeling good. His stomach would really bother him, and he even checked himself into the hospital a few times. But this time it was worse, and he checked himself in, and they decided they better do a CAT scan, and that's when they found the cancer.
And Willie, what was his prognosis?
Well, he was given 1 to 20, and he thought that was pretty funny. He said, well, nobody has any guarantees, and that's a pretty nebulous diagnosis. And so his plan was to shoot for the 20 and beyond. Very quickly, he morphed his life and his attitude into, as he was quoted in the Seattle Times, I didn't want to fall over dead at my desk. And so he decided he wanted to retire and do something that really made a difference for others.
So what exactly did he decide to do? What changes did he make?
He had worked with Results for about 10 years before he retired, but he branched out to working with Habitat for Humanity and the Make-A-Wish Foundation and trying to decide which one would be best for him. And he found that he could make the most difference working with the Results organization.
Do you feel like you understand why he made this decision? I mean, it would be, I can understand retiring. I feel like a lot of people might retire and then take time for themselves or go have adventures or, you know, check off stuff on their bucket list. But he didn't want to go do that. He decided, I'm going to go work really, really hard for no money. Why did he choose that?
Making a difference in the world, and especially being able to save lives, was just so important to him that he said, I can do this. These children don't have a voice. These people dying all over the world from HIV, AIDS, or malaria, or tuberculosis, which is now the biggest killer in our world, don't have a voice, but I have a voice. I live in a democracy, and I can use my voice to make a difference. And it was empowering, it was exciting, and it was satisfying to him to know that. And he said, the more I do, the more I realize I don't do. And that drove him on as well.
Do you think he succeeded in going into the end of his life without regrets? And if so, like, what is the secret? Because that is kind of what we all wanted to, right?
He was at a place in his life where he felt satisfied that he had done what he could do. If this had to be the end, that was okay, because he had had a good life and he had done his best. He was ready.
Yeah. Well, obviously, a loss to the broader community of work in global health and aid and the public sector and all these places where he's had an impact, but a loss to you of your brother. I wonder what you miss about him.
Mm-hmm. Well, pretty much everything. He was my best friend. He looked out for me for 66 years, and we were close. I miss his laugh. I miss his ability to have fun in almost any situation. I miss his advice. I miss his being. I always knew he was there, and that was very comforting to me.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss, and I appreciate you coming to tell us about your brother. Thank you so much.
Sure. I'm sure he would say, well, if they want to do anything in honor of me, tell them to call their congressman and get the Reach Every Mother and Child Act passed. we all have a voice and can make a difference.
Willie Dickerson is a retired teacher from Snohomish, Washington, and his brother Bob Dickerson died last year, and he was a longtime volunteer and advocate with the organization Results and many other causes. And again, thank you for coming to tell us a little bit of Bob's story.
Thank you.
Probably good for me to hear everyone check their vocal mic, please.
It's Sound Effect on KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here with our No Regrets show.
Check, check, check. Hey, 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 hey. Here yep. I am.
Hello. Hi. 1, 2, check.
Seattle indie rock band Chastity Belt has No Regrets, or I should say No Regerts. That's the name of their 2013 debut album.
Mic check. Hello. Hello, hello. Oh,
okay, good.
Check, check, check.
Julia Shapiro, Lydia Lund, Annie Truscott, and Gretchen Grimm joined Sound Effect's Kevin Kniestedt in KPLU Studios, and they explained to him why they stand behind even the intentionally misspelled tattoo that was the album's namesake. And they played a little music, too.
For those who might not know you all that well, how'd you guys get to know each other, and how'd you guys become a band?
We met in college. We all went to Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington. And we were all friends before the band. The band started as a joke. Lydia and I came up with the band name, Chastity Belt, when we were wasted one night at a frat party. And then it kind of just stuck, and we would start chants, Chastity Belt chants at shows after the other bands had played. It was kind of like our punk alter ego. Yeah. We would break bottles and then sweep them up because we felt bad.
So what were the early days of Chastity Belt like after that?
We played this one show. It was like the battle of the bands at this, again, a frat party.
Yeah, Beta Fest.
And we had one song, and it was really long and ridiculous. And then we had a break for the summer, and we came back, and Julia had written like a few songs, and we switched up instruments a little bit and actually started practicing.
Yeah, we sounded really bad, but I'd never played in a band before, so I thought that
one
we sounded
had,
good.
Yeah, it sounded good to me.
It sounded great to me, too.
And then we won Battle of Bands, and that pretty much has elevated us to where we are now, thanks to Beta Fest Battle of Bands.
I'd always wanted to be in a band, but it was kind of intimidating.
Yeah.
So starting as a joke made it easier.
Your most recent release is called Time to Go Home, but previously you had a release called No Regrets, intentionally spelled wrong.
Yeah.
Is there anything behind the title to that?
That's a tattoo that I have. Yeah. So we just kind of named it after that.
Yeah, and Julia had the idea to get that tattoo for like a couple years, and I kept being like, absolutely do not do that. That's the worst idea I've ever heard. And then she did it, and I love that tattoo.
Yeah.
So
it's good.
Maybe best decision she's ever made.
So I've interviewed a handful of musicians that have looked back on some of their earlier music and said, I can't believe I sang those lyrics. What was I thinking? How did I feel that way back then? Do you have any songs or lyrics that you look back on that you sang before? You're like, what was going on?
Definitely. I wouldn't say that I regret singing it, but I would like to never sing it again. The song Goddamn, which is just like so like cutesy. I don't think it's that bad, but I just would rather not sing it anymore.
Is it just the cutesy factor, or is there anything else?
Yeah, just kind of embarrassing to sing.
How come?
I don't know. It's just like about like thinking a guy is hot, which is funny. Like, I still think it's funny, but I'm just like, I have other things I'd like to sing about.
I don't feel regret that much, but the one time I felt intense regret was like when I was feeling really angsty my senior year of college.
Totally.
I studied math, and I was just so done with it. And I was like, this sucks. I'm bored. And I just wish I would have been an art major. I regretted being a math major so much in that one moment.
I
took one harp lesson in sixth grade, and I really wish I'd stuck with it. I wish that I could play
Me too. I would love for you to serenade me on that.
I kind of wish that I stuck with piano, because I took some piano lessons when I was 9.
I kind of feel like no regrets is a pretty good motto for our band in general.
Yeah.
Or life. No expectations, no regrets.
Yeah.
It's like we're all just like growing up a little bit, getting wiser and older, and
no regrets.
Well, Julia Shapiro, Lydia Lund, Annie Truscott, and Gretchen Grimm, the members of Chastity Belt, thank you so much for being here. Can you take us out with a song?
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Love to. We're going to play Caught in a Lie, which is a new song. You can find it on our next album, probably coming out in 2017 or at a live show.
Seattle band Chastity Belt talking with Sound Effects' Kevin Kniestad. You can see video of them performing two of their songs, including one exclusive unreleased track, at our Facebook page. Just go on Facebook and search for KPLU Sound Effect. You can also find it at kplusoundeffect.org. And since we had them here, we figured we might as well put them to work. So take it away.
Sound Effect is hosted by Gabriel Spitzer and produced by Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson. The show had help this week from Lol Kisau and John Kessler.
Sound effects intern is Ginny Palmer, with web help from Dave Nagaris. Sound effects executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Also, special thanks this week to Los Angeles Rams.
You can download the Sound Effect podcast on iTunes and follow Sound Effect on Facebook.
Be sure to tune in next week when we do some eavesdropping.
Hello, this is Marcos again. I would like to play another piece called Broadca. Here it is.
This is 88.5 KPLU.